If you didn't hear my session yesterday I was talking about settler privilege in general terms, and talking in specifically how we can approach this problem by trying to overcome the invisibility of First Nations that exists in this country. They are much more invisible than they are in Canada, because the percentage of population is much different. The percentage of population of First Nations people in the U.S. is only about 2%, and most of those live away from population centers. So in Mexico, the percentage is over 20%. So they see many more indigenous people. And I talked a little bit about what I call the origin stories of the U.S. that came from the very first settlements. One of them is the Thanksgiving story we're all familiar with, and how it goes down. It usually is portrayed as a kind of a morality play where the pilgrims seeking a place to exercise their religious freedom come, and they land in North America, and they have a very difficult first winter experience, and the kindly local natives come and help them out, and then in the fall they all have a nice big dinner together to celebrate everything, and then the Indians, because that's all they're ever called, just kind of move off stage and disappear. But of course that's not the way it happened. And the problem with that vision of things is that I think it has informed the basic problem of manifest destiny that became the way that American settlers looked at what was happening. That yes, we're going to get this land because we are destined to it. It is somehow some divine grace has come to us that we are able to do this. And many of them came to this country because they were right out of land where they lived. Small holding farms were just not making it. You know, the land had been divided and divided and divided for centuries, and you needed to go somewhere else to be able to live like a farmer. So that was yesterday. It kind of sets things up, and I talked about the local First Nations in New York State and Massachusetts that first encountered settlers. What I want to talk about today is westward expansion and how that was set up. Not so much the very early times, but really just before and at the beginning of the United States and on into the 19th century. Not very far into the 19th century, but into it. But first I would like to start by acknowledging that we're meeting today on the traditional territories of the Shalanmuch, the Tsintiatchuk, the Tsimpiskaushuk, the Squaxinuk, and the Mamachatpam people. Normally I would have a graphic that translated what those are, but I'll tell you that in a minute. And these people were the stewards of these lands and the waters since time immemorial. I grew up in the traditional territories of the Miamia, the Weachtanon, the Kinipiko, Miquati peoples, where my family had acquired land and settled more than 120 years before I was born. I offer my thanks and respect to these people, the people of all these nations, and condemn their forced removal from their lands. And I am committed to establishing a right relationship with the people, land, and waters of these places where I've lived, worked, and I vacation. That's a land acknowledgement, and it is meant to situate us on the land, explain why we're here. And it was usually something you did when you arrived in someone else's territory and you let them know why you're here and that you mean no harm, and they would usually respond by welcoming you, and you all went your way, and as long as you didn't step on their toes, that was fine. Those peoples that I listed were the Chelan, who lived down on Lake Chelan, the Entiat, who lived over in the next valley, the Wenatchee, who lived down by Wenatchee and up the Wenatchee River to Leavenworth, and the Tsinkius, or what were called in English the Moses Columbia people, who lived over in Moses Coulee area across the Columbia. But they happened to speak basically the same language of this, as this first bunch. And then the last one, the Mamachatpam, is the Yakamas. They speak an entirely different language, as different as Russian is from Swahili. And they were all living in this area for a long time before there was settler contact. I also acknowledge the ones that come from the area where I come from, because I will get around to be talking about them today, not in detail, but we'll as we go by mention them. So I want to introduce two different First Nations who were part of the first 13 colonies, and who are significant in kind of track the westward expansion. The first ones are the Lenape people, or the Delaware Nation, which occupied basically New Jersey, southern New York, Manhattan, and down through the Delaware Valley into Delaware Bay. They were, of course, they were the people that the Dutch first contacted in New York. We talked about that a bit yesterday. Their location, basically from Washington, D.C. up through the lower Hudson Valley and Long Island and so forth, really was the first place that any population of settlers of any size actually landed. And so they were some of the first people affected by the displacement that started to happen. And it wasn't all peaceable. In the case of Manhattan, the Dutch came in and they made an agreement with them, and they traded some trade goods, including the famous wampum that was supposed to be worth $26, which is a fiction, because wampum wasn't really currency. It was a trade good, or it was a credential, or it was a treaty item, or it was very significant, but it wasn't money. And they both misunderstood each other about what was going on. The Dutch thought they were buying it. They thought they bought Manhattan Island. The Lenape thought, well, here comes the visitors, you know, we'll do the sort of visitor deal here, and there's a bit of a charge for coming and kind of, you know, camping on our land and doing stuff, you know. But what they weren't prepared for, that more of them kept coming. And so things began to get testy between the Lenape and the Dutch, and they had a lot of skirmishes, and it continued that way for some time. And eventually, of course, the Dutch pulled up stakes and left. We'll get to that juncture in a moment. One other thing I want to do while I'm doing this is kind of correlate my family, my ancestors, with what's going on during the Western expansion, because it's very interesting. my family started out in the 13 colonies, and they started moving west. The First Nations that were there kept moving west before them, and we'll just kind of map that as we go through. In the case of the Lenape people, I had two, my sixth great-grandparents who ended up settling in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. In what is now Basking Ridge, New Jersey. They came from Ireland. Their names were James McCain and Mary McConnell. And they founded one branch of the family, and eventually they moved to Ohio. But James started a farm. His son fought in the Revolutionary War. His son. I have to keep the generations sorted here. And then, while this was happening, of course, the settlers from wherever they were coming were encroaching on the Lenape people. Now, the Lenape people were partly agricultural. They grew corn and things like, and squash and things like that. And they were in competition with the farmers for land. And eventually, it became more difficult for the Lenape people. They started moving westward. At the same time, even further back, I had some ancestors who came with the Dutch, and they landed in Manhattan. But they arrived in 1624 and established a farm as well, right on Manhattan Island. The Dutch sort of took over the southern tip of Manhattan, and they built a wall around it. And Wall Street is named for the northern perimeter of that wall. It's right on the southern tip of Manhattan. Broadway was a Lenape trail that ran up the middle of the island. And so that takes the geography of New York City and puts it down to its original basics. I had ancestors, a Philippe de Tru, who was born in northern France in what is now Belgium. It was France then. And his wife, Susanna de Chêne, who then, because they were Protestants, and the 17th century, you know, if you were a Protestant, it mattered where you lived, because the Spanish got control of that territory at a certain point, and the Spanish were not tolerating Protestants around. So they moved to Amsterdam. Philippe was a dyer, and so Amsterdam was this great mercantile center, and he got a job, and he was dyeing fabric. But then the Dutch were interested in the New York area, and they set up a company like they had for the Dutch East India Company, which sent, you know, the merchants to the Spice Islands and to Indonesia to collect spices, and they were making tons of money on that, so they thought that was a good idea. So they started the Dutch West India Company, and they wanted to send people to America. So Philippe and his wife decided that they would sign a contract with the Dutch West India Company to go to New York, and they'd get a farm. They wouldn't have to live in the city and do dyeing and all that stuff. So they went to New York, and they got a farm, and it was, as far as I can tell from the records, it was right close to where the Brooklyn Bridge is now on the right, or on the outer shore of Manhattan Island. This probably resulted in some cultural conflict, so because that end of Manhattan Island was covered with a forest, and that forest was full of hickory trees, and it was a culturally important place for the Lenape, because that's where they got all their bows and arrows. They made them all from hickory, And they went and they harvested the staves, and they came from all over Lenape territory to get the hickory from Manhattan Island. And here, the Dutch went and took the southern end of it and just raised the forest and made a nice little city wall and put a town in the center of it. So Long Island, Manhattan, and the mainland all were subject to these skirmishes between the Lenape and the Dutch. And so in 1668, the Dutch left. It was getting too expensive for them to stay there because they had to maintain so much military presence to protect all of their settlements. It wasn't going to be profitable. And in fact, a few years later after this, the Dutch West India Company just folded because they just weren't doing anything in the Western Hemisphere. So those are the Lenape, and already, as we saw in the 18th century, they were starting to creep westward. The other First Nation I want to talk about are the Shawnees, because they were very significant in the, particularly in the early period of the 19th century and the westward expansion and how it played out, because the Shawnee chiefs were very obstinate and they were not happy with this whole idea of settlement. And they led the resistance against the further westward settlement. And one of the things that First Nations people tell me is that they don't like this fiction that, you know, there was the Thanksgiving and the natives were kindly, and then all of the settlement happened, and it was these intrepid Indian fighters that then pushed the natives back and just to make room for all the settlers, and that, it sort of glosses over a whole series of things. In fact, the westward expansion was very difficult and relatively slow. And what I want to get to today is talk about the instruments that both the British, but particularly the American government, used to push that frontier of expansion as far west as they could. Basically, it's wars, treaties, and reservations. The reservations start to become important a little later as you get further west. But the wars and treaties were the first instruments that people used. And it's fair to say that from about 1700 on, it was basically a constant form of warfare between the First Nations and the settlers. And it really started to come to a peak about the middle of the 18th century. I would be showing you a nice map of North America, showing you where the French territory was, because beyond the British areas, there were the French. And the Dutch had already left, but the British kept having these skirmishes with the French, and what happened would be that all of the First Nations would line up on one side or the other. The Shawnee didn't like the British, so they were fighting with the French. And that kind of warfare went on for almost 100 years. It didn't accomplish much until about 1760. The basic outlines of the 13 colonies were settled by then. The French and Indian Wars changed the strategic landscape, because at the end of it, in the Treaty of Paris in 1763, the French decided to leave North America. And so they left Quebec, and England took that over and called it the Province of Quebec, which the people who were living there thought was very quaint, that they lived in a place that had a name that was English. And they still don't like that. They they want to be always be known in French. And that meant that the land just beyond the Appalachian Mountains was now no longer French. However, when the war ended, King George III made a royal proclamation because he realized that the First Nations, who were already being pushed west, were upset about this movement. He made a royal proclamation drawing a line down the ridge of the Appalachian Mountains. And it said, and the proclamation basically said, "Thou shalt not settle west of here." And this, although the British were the only major power east of the Mississippi, they drew the line and said, no settlement beyond this line. And this act set the stage for Western expansion, but not in the way that people had hoped, and they were upset. The colonists, the whole colonial enterprise had been as much economic as political. The colonies were seen as a place where we could make money. And there were British investors back in England who were willing to invest in sending colonists out because they think they could get export goods out of the colonies that would be lucrative for the British economy. And they had seen that happening in the 17th century. The first thing that everybody discovered was there were lots of beavers in North America, and they loved beaver pelts, and the First Nations were delighted to sell them lots of beaver pelts. But they wanted much more. They wanted crops like tobacco and so forth. So the result of this royal proclamation was frustration on the part of the colonists. They wanted more land beyond the line. There had already been companies formed. There was an Ohio company, an Indiana company, and their purpose was land speculation, and they had hired frontiersmen and what they called Indian fighters to help their scouts and surveyors go into this territory and find really good land that they could try and claim. So the concept of Indian fighter was extremely important in those colonies. You know, Daniel Boone was one of them, and they were the people who lived on the western edge of the colonies and were sent into this so-called no man's land to try to find land that would make good future investments. The colonies themselves realized that line also was a kind of a military line, and there were skirmishes still that went on across it. The First Nations didn't necessarily obey the line. They were relieved that it was there because it stopped this large surge of Englishmen from coming across the line and settling where they lived. So the colonies organized militias to kind of clear the western boundary areas of First Nations. And that began to drive those communities even further west. So the Lenape, who started out in New Jersey and New York, were by the 1760s in western Pennsylvania. And the situation by 1765 was that the Lenape found themselves in Ohio. The Ohio country was now the golden land that everybody dreamed of having, but still couldn't have yet. The Shawnee that I mentioned were already active up in the Northwest Territories, even though their home territory was Western Virginia, where West Virginia is now, Tennessee and Kentucky, they were now moving up into Indiana, and the British ran into them there. There were three Shawnee chiefs killed in skirmishes with the British around 1765. By 1768, the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois Federation in upstate New York, who basically controlled the northern part of Ohio, left it to the British. Now, they were the only First Nation in the colonies who were really good allies of the British, and they were always very kind to them, and they said, all right, you can have northern Ohio back. But by this time, this line was already leaking settlers into Kentucky through the Cumberland Gap. The Cumberland Gap was the easiest pass through the Appalachians, and people were just trekking through there now. And people like Daniel Boone were being hired to lead groups into the Kentucky country to start settling. By 1770, the Shawnee were so alarmed that they tried to put together an alliance of First Nations west of the line to try and stop all of this. They were unsuccessful in the first instance. They came back later and they tried later on. So that by 1775, there were 50,000 settlers west of the line, mostly in the area around the Cumberland Gap and in the southern Ohio country into the Ohio Valley. At this time, there was a consciousness that, you know, because of this line, the stuff beyond that was called Indian country. And that becomes a theme. Indian country keeps moving further west. And by the way, Indian country is still the term used in the U.S. military to designate enemy territory. It was the edges of Indian country and where they met the colonial areas were the scenes of some of the most brutal warfare. And in particular, the militias, the Kentucky militia was a famous one. They paid their men on a bounty system. And so the militia members would get paid when they produced scalps. It was, there was considerable resistance, and as time went on, it became more and more evident, particularly to the Shawnee chiefs, that there needed to be even more resistance. It was also illegal to buy land in this area, even though some of these companies who were trying to be land speculators tried. And there was one called the Wabash River Company, or the Wabash Land Company, that actually succeeded in buying some land in the area of the Wabash River in Indiana. And the British government found out about it, and they nullified the deal. Because they said the First Nations can only sell land to the Crown. You're a private group. You can't buy land. And they had to do this to keep the First Nations placated, because they were already upset enough. Around this same time in 1775, the Lenape, who were now in Ohio, worked out a deal with the Miamis, who were the main body of First Nations in Indiana, where they could move into Indiana because they didn't like the way things were looking in Ohio as people began trickling up from this crowd of 50,000 that were already across the border. The Miamis were okay with this because and by about 1740, the Miami's population had been considerably reduced by epidemics, measles, smallpox, and other European diseases they had no resistance to. Can anyone remember the name of an important Shawnee chief? Does Tecumseh come to mind? Well, about this time I'm talking about, he was only 7 years old, but there was another one, his name was Hokalasquaw, which translates as Chief Cornstalk. And he's probably the most important First Nations figure that no one's ever heard of. He was the chief, he was the war chief of the Shawnee, kind of in the area of eastern Kentucky, on the edge of what is now West Virginia. And in his earlier days, he was quite adamantly opposed to all of the settlement. He fought against the British. He fought against the British in the French and Indian War. He tried very hard to keep settlers out of Ohio. But eventually he became an advocate for peace. He turned out to be a key figure in a seemingly unimportant war. Every general who had gotten a skirmish tried to get their thing named a war. And there was a certain Lord Dunmore who only fought the Shawnee for a few months, but you know, he managed to get himself a named war, Lord Dunmore's War. It was in 1774. But Chief Cornstalk was leading the Shawnee warriors against the British forces, and they had a battle at Point Pleasant, which is kind of the western edge of the Virginia Territory at the time. It's now in West Virginia. And he lost. So here's a chief who lost the battle. And you know, he was taken prisoner, and then he was released after it was evident that the native forces were going to demilitarize and disperse. And so he went back to his community. And when the Revolutionary War started after the Declaration of Independence, he took a position of neutrality between the British and the Americans. In 1777, he started to be worried about the Americans because they were building forts near their territory. And so he went to one of them, Fort Randolph, which was in Point Pleasant, which was this site of the previous battle. He wanted to bargain with them about, you know, well, you know, if you guys do something for us, we'll just stay neutral. The commander was not amused and took him prisoner. He took the whole delegation hostage. He treated them nicely. He put them in a cabin right outside the fort and put him under guard, and was going to decide what to do with them. But then in a totally unrelated incident, some First Nations elsewhere killed some settlers, and the local settlement got furious, and they heard about these war chiefs who were in this cabin down here, and they turned in an angry mob, and they marched down to this cabin, and they killed all of the delegation who were there. And it was, the response to this was interesting, because the people of Virginia were quite indignant about this, because this Chief Hokalasquaw had come in peace and he was trying to work out a diplomatic solution to something. And so the governor of Virginia, Henry Clay, was outraged, and he ordered them to arrest the man who killed them. They took them into custody, but nobody would testify against them. And they couldn't take First Nations people's testimony, because all of them who were there were killed. So this one thing turned the rest of the Shawnee Nation against the American government. They had been neutral and they turned against them. And this is going to, this turned them into the leaders of the resistance in the West. And they didn't go away. They continued fighting, and they figured in the development of the Midwestern U.S. for the next 50 years. And while we're going through this, I have more ancestors that were located in this territory. I find it instructive to do this because it helps me understand my personal connection to what was going on here. I had two ancestors who came from Ireland and settled in Staunton, West Virginia. They were another set of six great-grandparents. They came in 1733, and they settled there, and while all this was going on there, he joined the Virginia militia. He almost certainly had fought against the Shawnees, as I just described, because the militias were involved in all of those fights with the Shawnees. He must have known all of that brutal frontier warfare with the scalping and bounties. And he might well have fought against Cornstalk at Point Pleasant. So that's Robert Patrick Bratton and Jean Ann McFarland, two people fleeing Ireland and the difficulties of the farm communities there. They had a farm in Staunton, which is east of Charlottesville, and it was kind of expected that if you were a settler there, you spent some time in the militia, at least a year. There wasn't any formal draft, but it was an expectation. So what happened after this? The fighting moved into the Midwest, and it went on in Ohio and Indiana. In 1791, which is after the establishment of the U.S. government, there was a Shawnee-led alliance of Miamis from Indiana, a group called the Eel River Miami, who claimed they never were Miamis anyway, although they spoke it, and the Shawnees, and the Shawnee war chief at the time, Cornstalk had retired, but this young war chief named Blue Jacket, who was named that because he always wore a blue jacket, he'd gotten it off some soldier or something, tried to chase the new American army around after the establishment of the U.S. And he was joined by a chief from the Eel River group named Little Turtle. Little Turtle was for that time not all that little. He was stood over 6 feet tall, and he loved bangly jewelry, silver jewelry and stuff, but he was a brilliant tactician. And in sort of right along the Indiana-Ohio border in 1791, they cornered a force of about 1,000 men from the Continental Army led by a General St. Clair. Now, the Continental Army, after the Revolutionary War, was depleted, broke, and exhausted. But nonetheless, they had to go out and patrol these frontiers. They tried to let the local militias do it as much as possible, but St. Clair's group was engaged by Little Turtle and Blue Jacket and their forces, and they soundly defeated them. And this battle, which is just called St. Clair's defeat, is also one of those things that happened that nobody's heard of that actually had an enormous influence on what happened later. Because President Washington was really upset about this. We should not be taking defeats like this. This is unacceptable. And so in the same way that the murder of Cornstalk had angered the Shawnees, Washington was mad about this defeat. And there was a third chief that was, a third war chief that was in this alliance, a very young war chief named Tecumseh, who was a very well-known brave who would go on to become a prominent figure in what happened in the early 19th century. Now, I think I can do this on my computer audio if I crank it way up. I have an audio clip of an author who wrote a book about William Henry Harrison, because it turns out now that the next thing that happens after St. Clair's defeat is that in 1795, the alliance of the Shawnees was defeated in northwest Ohio, and at a battle called the Battle of Fallen Timbers. There had been a tornado there just before the battle, and it was all this jumble of downed forest. General Anthony Wayne, who was one of the generals that Washington had sent in to clean up the area because he didn't like his army being defeated on the frontier like this, managed to defeat them. And then there was a treaty talk at Greenville, Ohio. And the Treaty of Greenville then became one of the keystones of the opening of Western movement. One of Wayne's officers there was an Ohioan named William Henry Harrison, who went on to become the 9th president. And Harrison was part of the treaty negotiations, and he was a kind of a rising star in the army, so he was destined for great things. In fact, he took time off from the army to go to Washington and to hang out with congressmen and do various things because he was obviously very ambitious. So what figures in what's going to be happening next is that in the early part of the 19th century, various things were going on that were looking westward. In 1803, the newly installed President Jefferson started set up the Lewis and Clark expedition, which actually through 1804 through 1806 went out to the Pacific coast. They wanted to explore and just see what the full possibility of Western expansion was. You remember the Brattons that I mentioned who lived in Virginia? Well, their grandson at this point, William Bratton, was also one of who would have been my fourth great-grandfather, was chosen to go on the Lewis and Clark expedition. The thing that Harrison did was his ambition and his interest in continuing on the work that started at the Treaty of Greenville, which basically managed to disperse this alliance that had formed, And after that treaty, there were three main nations that had been partially in Ohio that completely left Ohio and ended up in Indiana. Those were the remaining Shawnee, the remaining Lenape or Delawares, and the Miamis. The Miamis were mainly in Indiana to start with, but some of them were in Ohio too. So Ohio had been cleared up, and now Harrison thought it would be a good idea to do that in Indiana. And he got his opportunity when, right before Jefferson was to be inaugurated, John Adams, who was the outgoing president, said to him, "Would you like to become the governor of the new territory of Indiana because we're about to let Ohio into the Union?" The operating procedure was, once you get a territory cleared out of First Nations people, it's good to be set up as a state, and you can go in and survey and have widespread settlement there. And that was the plan for Ohio. So Harrison wrote a letter to Jefferson, who he knew was coming in as president, and said, "You know, if I take this job, you know, you're not going to fire me or anything, are you?" And he said, no. And they actually saw eye to eye on things. So the author of this book, it's called Mr. Jefferson's Hammer. It's a biography of William Henry Harrison. And that was his reputation. I'm going to try to play it on my computer audio, but we don't have the whole AV setup going, but I'll crank the sound way up and hopefully you can hear it. There we go.
Going on, but in 1802, rumors start swirling about that the French are going to retake the Louisiana territory just west of the Mississippi River. And this basically, and of course, this is Napoleonic France, whereas before it had been held by the Spanish, who aren't particularly aggressive or even militarily competent by this point. And the idea that Napoleon might be taking over Louisiana territory sends Jefferson into a panic. And from late 1802 into 1803, he writes this secret private letter to Harrison, basically telling him to do almost anything he can to buy up Indian lands on the Mississippi and the Ohio River as quickly and cheaply as he can. Jefferson's idea is, and this really becomes hardened by early 1803, Jefferson's idea is we want to buy up that land and get as many white settlers on them as we can, because they'll serve as a militia who are going to stop Napoleon, which is kind of an optimistic goal, I would argue, at this point. But anyway, this is when he basically gives Harrison the green light to sort of do what, you know, any means necessary to negotiate these treaties quickly and cheaply. What's really fascinating is, you know, within a year, the United States has actually purchased all the Louisiana territory. And so, in theory, that desperate need for quick land acquisition is gone. And yet, at the same time, Jefferson really likes buying up Indian lands cheaply. This sort of fits some of his broader goals. And Harrison, turns out, is really, really good at this. Not necessarily at doing it in a way that's going to make Indians happy, but he's very effective at buying up this land quickly and cheaply. And that's the name of the game. And he basically continues in that mode. The way I usually describe it in class is I'll pick three random students and I'll get their names. And then I will play, of course, the part of William Henry Harrison because I'm wearing a tie. And I will pick two of the students and say, "Oh, hey, well, would you mind coming to my Indian council? And I would like to buy that third student's desk. Would you first two students be willing to buy sell me the third student's desk for $500 a year?" And of course they say yes, because it's not their desk and they really don't care. Then you invite student one and student three and ask them if you could buy student number two's disk. It seems sort of like a silly, reductive exercise, but it's basically how these treaties worked. Harrison was very good at figuring out which Indian chiefs were willing to play ball with him, which ones were desperate enough for some annuities and some other government perks, that they would basically agree to sell their neighbor's land, whether they had decent claim to them or not. And as far as Harrison was concerned, you know, as long as I get Indians to sign on the dotted line, it's perfectly good. And Jefferson was more than willing to accept, you know, Indian treaties like that. The very early 19th century is this odd period between the Treaty of Greenville in 1795, which basically ended wide-scale warfare north of the Ohio River. And, of course, William Henry Harrison was not only in the army that had sort of led up to that treaty, but also at the treaty negotiations. And I would argue, and other people would argue, that he got sort of a first-hand lesson in how to conduct Indian treaties at Greenville. And then for the next decade or so, you basically have the Indian population north of the Ohio River is in really awful straits. The Napoleonic Wars has killed the fur trading economy. Alcoholism is rampant. They are very much a dispirited, defeated people. And prior to 1805, it's actually relatively easy for him to do this. It's after the year 1805 when we start seeing religious revivals among the Indians north of the Ohio, most famously that of a guy named Tetzcuatawa, or the Shawnee Prophet, particularly when his warrior brother Tecumseh gets involved. That's when Harrison actually has to sort of change tactics a bit, because they basically hold to the idea that no Indian should sell any land to the United States under any circumstances, and that's sort of directly opposite him. So he's going to have to adopt a number of tactics. He tries to win the prophet over, and then he sort of starts seeing, well, he's a tool of the British, and we have to watch out for him. But basically, there isn't any real... There are occasional sort of flare-ups, maybe threats of force, but you really don't have actual combat until late 1811, which, again, most historians would probably argue, as far as the Ohio Valley goes, the War of 1812 actually starts in late 1811.
So how long was he in this position?
So that gives you an overview of what was going on in the Indiana Territory. And he mentions this time in 1805, Tecumseh, the Shawnee war chief's brother, who, although he was from a chiefly clan, was never amounted to anything until he got religion. And he decided, he said, part of our problem with all of these settlers is we're not going back to our religious roots and sticking by our principles. And one of those is we just don't buy and sell land. And so, the sort of saying is that the land doesn't belong to us, we belong to the land. And so you can't sell the land. Meanwhile, the conditions under which European countries were, quote, discovering land, were that if you discover it, meaning that if you find land where there are no other Christian people living, you can just take it. And if there are people living there, then they can sell their land, but the only people they can sell it to is you, and in this case, the British Crown. The U.S. government considered, and in fact, in 1823, it was confirmed by the Supreme Court, that they inherited this from the British when they became independent. So, Harrison was the main actor for the United States in Indiana and Illinois out to the Mississippi River. This guy, the prophet, decided he was going to establish a kind of a headquarters, a place for people to do pilgrimages and come and see him and so forth. And they named it, it got the English name Prophetstown, because what they called it was basically the same thing if you translate it from the Shawnee. And they located it at the site of an old French fort. The French fort had been built next to what was a long-established settlement of the Miami people. So here the Shawnees were kind of mixing with Miamis, and it was a big center, and people were coming there for this renewal that, you know, don't sell land to the Americans, and don't put up with settlers. That was basically their creed. Well, and you can imagine how Harrison reacted to this. He was very frustrated with this because he had a formula that was working for him, and then all of a sudden it stopped. And these pesky Shawnees would not go away. On the other hand, there were enough of them around, and this is the other part of the equation. Tecumseh had been traveling. He had been traveling north and south. He had gone down into Alabama and Georgia. He had been up into Canada, and he was assembling a big alliance of First Nations. And Harrison was concerned that he might actually succeed, and in fact he was having some success. And Tecumseh was already a feared figure because he was a well-known war chief who had been very successful on a smaller scale, and it looked like on a large scale he could be a formidable opponent. So Harrison was about 100 miles southwest of this prophet's town, and he got information that Tecumseh had left and taken a bunch of braves, and they were going off probably up to Canada to have more meetings about their alliance. And so the prophet was alone at home, and in November of 1811, which was referenced in there, he snuck up on the town and attacked it and defeated the prophet and the remaining Shawnees. And that essentially was the thing that broke the possibility of there being an effective resistance anymore. And Harrison got a lot of mileage out of this victory. It was a battle that took place on the confluence of the Tippecanoe River and the Wabash River. And they started calling Harrison Old Tippecanoe. And when he ran for president later on, that was part of his campaign slogan. Because his vice president's name was Tyler, it was Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And of course, the Shawnee were dispirited now, and Tecumseh really had no coherent army or alliance to work with, and there was nothing more to do. This kind of set up the situation for the 1830s, and which is kind of the next chapter in this story, and that's we've worked from the 13 colonies to the Mississippi, and what happens next is the completion of the cleaning out of east of the Mississippi, everywhere that Andrew Jackson wants to achieve. When Andrew Jackson becomes president in 1829, that was part of his State of the Union address. I'm going to take all of the Indians out of the eastern part of the U.S. and we're going to build new states and carry on. And I should add that at about the time that this Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811 was going on, there were lots of other things happening. It was, as the author of this book mentioned, this was just about the time the War of 1812 was going to start. And one of the concerns that the Americans had was that this big Indian coalition was going to side with the British. So his this Battle of Tippecanoe was pivotal in preventing that from happening. And of course, the U.S. went on to win the War of 1812. That leaves us then at this point, and I'm going to pick up with that tomorrow, because the next chapter is now about reservations. The treaty process had been worked out and how the U.S. government wanted to operate with it. In 1778, they had made the very first treaty, back when they were the Continental Congress and the U.S. Constitution hadn't been written yet. And they made a treaty with the Lenape people in western Pennsylvania. And they gave them this very simple treaty that had two clauses in it, basically. It said, we will now respect your territory. And they, you know, they had to define where their territory was. And not only that, that in the future as we develop more states, we will develop a state particularly for First Nations people, and you, the Delaware Nation, will be the head of it. So they offered them the sun and the moon, basically. Of course, that treaty never went anywhere because the governance structure of the U.S. changed, and you know it wasn't on the record anymore because all that stuff was thrown out the window. But reservations became the way that First Nations people were moved out of the way from then on, and it goes all the way out to the West. And we'll talk about around here what happened when they tried to get the reservation system set up in Washington, and the parallels that you will see of how Governor Stevens, who was governor of the Washington Territory, managed his treaty process. And it had direct effect on this land right here, because all of those nations that I mentioned at the beginning of the hour were part of that treaty process, even though a couple of them said, no, we're not. We refuse to be part of it. They got written into it anyway, even though they didn't sign it. I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about and rather than just talking abstractly about, you know, all these events that go on here, what people can take away when they go home and what they can do, what you can do to see how you fit into this picture, even though it's back in the history. To understand prejudice, we have to look at how it developed and the policies around land and sovereignty are key in understanding how the United States came to be the way it is and how the First Nations people ended up marginalized the way they are. I was going to have a nice list that you could see, but I'll pick some of these. And one of them is locate the land you live, work, and vacation on, and find out which First Nations may claim it. And I remember when I was 9 asking my mother, Mom, what Indians lived around here? And she couldn't tell me. She guessed the Kickapoo, you know, and so that's what I thought when I was a kid. Once you know who they are, look into their history. What happened? Are they still around? If not, where did they go? For example, the Lenape people I've been talking about have a reservation. Does anybody know where it is? It's not in New Jersey or New York, or it's in Oklahoma. And that's part of this next chapter, is how did this stuff happen. But you can find out there is if you look at the west end in the dining hall, there's a big board about land acknowledgments, and they have instructions on how you can find where your address would land in terms of native land claims. There are websites that you type in your address and it will show you a map that shows who claims the territory you live on. It's complicated because First Nations may have lived in several different places, and they usually will claim all the places they ever lived. And so those will overlap. For example, this land is claimed by the reservation that represents the Chelan and Entiat First Nations, and also the Yakimas. This is part of the larger Yakima land claim. So that gives you an insight into how your particular space came to be. The other thing that I recommend people, and I'll just give you a couple today, and we're going to be talking about this again tomorrow, but try and find indigenous voices for your information. I think there are two ways to do that. Once you know which nations claim the land you live on, go to their website. They'll have their own version of their history. Read that. They will have perhaps some current issues or political issues that they have on their website. It's very instructive to read. I read the websites of nations all the time, and I find out how they think and what's going on and how they view their own history. The other thing that you can do is that there are lots of indigenous-run information outlets. And one that I like, it's a long-standing, it was originally kind of a newspaper, then it became a website and it has a big social media presence, and it was called Indian Country Today. And it's now, actually in the last couple of months, has gone down to an abbreviation, ICT. But I get updates from them, and current affairs, news things that you see will be interpreted from a Native perspective, and that helps you understand, you know, how they see these things. You see things commemorated, like there were events recently, like around Memorial Day, for the veterans who are code talkers, particularly the Diné or Navajo people who were used to speak to each other over the radio because the Germans couldn't decipher what they were saying. And those veterans are getting very old. There's still a couple of them left. And it's interesting to see the mainline press coverage of those things and compare it to the way an indigenous outlet would cover it. The other thing that you might look into is the land back movement. And all you have to do is Google land back, all one word. And it's kind of, right now it's kind of a loose but growing movement of First Nations people and supporters who want to organize some way to give some of their land back. The land back movement has pointed out, and I went and got the Department of Interior's report on this, that the U.S. government, basically the way European land ownership worked, according to the rules set out in the 15th century by the popes, was and it was based on the European system of sovereignty, that basically everything belongs to the king, but the king can give land to a duke, who can turn around and give it to an earl, who can turn around, and it goes down the line until you get down to the serfs, who don't get given anything, but they're allowed to work the land, and they have to stay on it and produce stuff. You know, it was half slavery. So anything that is not set aside and titled to some individual belongs to the crown. In Canada, we still call it crown land if it's government land. And here in the U.S., it's federal land. The U.S. government owns over 600 million acres of federal land, of which 2/3 belong to the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Bureau of Land Management, most of the lands they have are not what we would call productive. A lot of BLM land is, for example, out here is just rangeland. It's where people can turn their cattle loose. And the First Nations are not asking for all of this back. But they have certain areas that are sacred to them, that are important to them in various ways, that they might request back. And they have put in requests. And so I think that's a discussion that's going to become even more current, because the current Department of Interior is much more friendly to that. They're working very hard on that. And they're working on a major report that's going to come out in I don't know how long it'll take. It might take a couple of years. Addressing a variety of things from residential schools through the issue of land. And that will become a conversation. And I suggest that one thing we can do is look into that and become conversant on the issue. So that's a good stopping point, because I would start going into the further westward expansion, which is a kind of a different story. This is kind of the colonial era, and the early American government era looks like it belongs back in the 18th century, and the 19th century became very wild and woolly and different. And the 19th century, in historical terms, for this purpose, begins after the War of 1812, where basically it's clear sailing to the Pacific as far as settlement goes. So, do you have any questions or comments on any of this?
The War of 1812, that was the British attempting to come in through the South.
It was everywhere, because it was very much a naval war. The British thought, oh, we've got the great navy, and we really got stung, you know, trying to traipse around North America. We'll try the naval. You know, this was the era of John Paul Jones, and there were battles in the Great Lakes, because the British were north of the Great Lakes, right? They really didn't want to invade the U.S. and, you know, come streaming across the Canadian. Well, it wasn't even the Canadian border then, because Canada hadn't been formed. But they didn't want to come back south and get driven north again. But that ended up being what happened, you know, because they did drive out down into. You know, it was the Brits were the ones who set fire to the White House.
But they wanted to take territory.
Yeah, but they were driven back eventually. So,
was the fact that Tecumseh was taken out of the picture possibly some incentive for the British, because they said, okay.
Yes.
Now the Indians are not going to be held to not selling to the Americans, so we can just take it.
Well, I think it was more of a strategic thing, that it helped that Harrison defeated. It helped the British make up their mind that when Harrison defeated them. Because the Shawnee coalition would have fought the Americans, but I think the British then looked at this and said, "Oh gosh, we're going to have to do this ourselves," you know, and that's why the author of that book, Mr. Jefferson Hammer, said that the War of 1812 really started with the defeat of the Shawnee at Tippecanoe. It was the next, I forget what month it started in, but it was the next spring that the hostility started with the British.
And was Oklahoma the state that you were talking about? Was the place where it was promised to the
group? No, they didn't have anything specific in mind, just some future state that we were going to do. And of course, that evaporated, that treaty. And there's something like, there are about 185 treaties, meaning treaties that were approved by Congress. And to my knowledge, none of them has ever been completely, implemented and honored. Yeah. The Dawes Act, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when they thought they were finished with reservations, then they started picking away at the reservations and dissolving them, and because they wanted even more land, and so the whole idea of this homesteading and converting Indian land into individual tracts. There was a doctrinaire reason for that, because some of the people in Washington are saying, well, it isn't just that we need to give them land, we have to convert them to the virtues of capitalism and teach them how to work. People literally said these things, teach them how to work and how to operate a farm or, and so forth. And at the same time, they were building these boarding schools, which had the same objective, and they were mostly not academic schools, but they taught a lot of industrial arts. They taught them how to garden. Like, the schools had orchards and gardens, and the students worked long hours in them. I will get into the boarding schools at the end and talk about how they were just kind of the final. As someone said, if you look at one of these, how can you distinguish it from a concentration camp?
Thank you.
Yeah.